Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so I think we can start this evening's questions. So let's see what happens. Okay, there is a kind of restlessness being developed in Sri Lanka with the growth of Muslims. We get lots of emails frequently asking not to buy from Muslims and to avoid halal food items. Okay, there's also an organized group led by some monks who carry out protests against Muslim activities. How should we act in this situation to avoid conflict? Okay, I think, unfortunately, it is a fairly kind of worldwide phenomenon. It's not, I think, it's if you are a good Muslim, it's not so easy these days because, you know, Islam has sometimes gotten a bit of a bad name because of the activities of a few extremists and a few bad people. And this is probably maybe what you're referring to is a kind of backlash against the Muslim community. So basically, you can assume, just like with everybody else, that the vast majority of Muslims are going to be likely to be good people, good-hearted, with good intentions, you know, just like everybody else is in the world. So don't let's be careful not to kind of tarnish everybody with the same brush, because essentially human character is the same, right? It doesn't really matter what religion you belong to. Below that, the human character is the same. The fact that you have been born into the human realm means you have certain characteristics which are common to all human beings. So a lot of the time, I think we have to kind of ignore these kind of things and not to take it too seriously, to understand that people react emotionally to, you know, the horrors that a few people perpetrate. And this is what people react to. People then become upset with the Muslims. So you can have compassion with both sides, both the Muslims and also those who then feel upset about the Muslim activities. But let's not fall into the trap where we start demonizing the Muslims, because then we just create making something worse out of a situation which already is bad enough. So as Buddhists, let's try to be compassionate and kind in everything we do. That's always the good sort of best solution to any kind of problem, I think. Yeah. So let's try to see the good in people where we possibly can and forgive in other situations. And then we are doing our bit, at least, for more peace and more harmony in a world where there's so much trouble already. I'm not sure if that really answered your question, but that's... Okay, dear Ajahn, I did not understand that how you related the passages of Majjhima number 2 to clear comprehension of the gradual training. Can you please explain under whose terms you matched both sutta sections? Okay, well, basically it is the point really is that the, you know, all the suttas are quite gradual in nature. So usually you can see the gradual training in pretty much any sutta. The suttas are structured like that throughout. So if you compare the suttas and you look at them, you can see how the various sections match up. So in the gradual training, you have the sense restraint, right? Then you have the full awareness. And then after full awareness comes the abandoning of the hindrances. That's the standard sequence. Sense restraint, full awareness, abandoning the hindrances. We haven't yet looked at the abandoning of the hindrances. That's coming one of these days sooner, either tomorrow or the day after. Then when you go on to Majjhima 2, the Savasava Sutta, you see a similar pattern. You see, first of all, you see the sense restraint, right? Exactly the same thing as in the gradual training. And then you have three sections which are not found in the gradual training. And then you have the abandoning of the hindrances. In this case, it is actually the abandoning of the three types of unwholesome thoughts that is very closely related to the abandoning of the hindrances. So you can see that those three sections in the Sabbasava Sutta stand in exactly the same place as the full awareness section in the gradual training here. So I'm not saying that these things are exactly the same. Usually they're not exactly the same, but what I'm saying is that they're very closely related to each other here, and that the three sections in the Sabbasava Sutta are likely to be a type of full awareness. There might be more to it, but that certainly is an important part of it, and that's why it's mentioned like that. So this is how you match up the suttas, and you can use one sutta to expand another one, and it all fits together very nicely. So I hope that makes sense. In the Visuddhimagga and practices derived from it, has the attitude towards the samatha practice as calming the mind in whichever way, and that in samadhi. But what we see in contrast that in the suttas you work on reducing the defilements, purify the mind, overcome the five hindrances, and then jhana happens arising here from the early seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Can you comment on that, please, that situation? It's not really different. Samatha is really abandoning the defilements, and samatha are just two aspects of the same thing, right? When the defilements get abandoned, you actually feel peace inside of you. The defilements are what drive the mind. Remember, part of the defilement is desire and craving, right? A craving is always the driver inside of you that makes you do things, that takes you out into the world to act. Craving is not a peaceful thing. It's the opposite of samatha. So getting rid of craving is the same thing as calming the mind. Ill will is the same kind of thing. Ill will drives you to action. It is something which is not peaceful. So by reducing ill will and harming, again, we're actually calming down the mind. So reduction of defilements and calming are just two sides of the same coin. The dog doesn't really make any difference. So any kind of meditation that you do which calms you down, or any kind of thing, any kind of thinking or reflection that you do that reduces the defilement, they're both basically the same kind of thing. So, and you find that probably both in the Visuddhimagga and the suttas, I would say. The Visuddhimagga is more focused on, it talks about the Patavikasinna, the earth kasinna, and tells you how to develop that kasinna practice to the first jhana. That's basically how it does it. I'm not all that familiar with the Visuddhimagga. I've read only little bits and pieces here and there, so I can't really comment too much. But certainly, these things are essentially the same thing here. But again, if there is a difference, I would say always go to the suttas as the final authority on how to practice. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Move on to the next one. Okay. Dear teacher, it says here, it's very, very nice. Someone said that do walk meditation can reach jhana. Can this happen or not? Okay, so can you reach jhana through walking meditation? This is the question. Well, the point is that everything we do is geared towards calming the mind and attaining samadhi, right? So the question, I suppose, is can you actually attain jhana while walking? Maybe that's the question. Of course, the walking meditation itself, it certainly helps to that goal, right? It's part of the practice of calming down, of overcoming the defilements, of reflecting in a wise way so that defilements go down. So it's part of that. So it certainly takes you a long way on that path. But whether actually you can attain jhana while walking, I don't think so. I think that's impossible. And basically, you remember that the state of jhana is a state where the body disappears, right? There is no body anymore. Once you become very, very peaceful, it becomes impossible to walk. You don't want to walk anymore. You just want to sit down. This is one of the things that you find in the suttas before, at the very beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, and we'll have a look at that in a few days' time. It says you sit down, right? This is a standard instruction. So any meditation practice that is geared towards samadhi, you always sit down first of all. You don't do it while walking. So I would say the answer is probably no, you cannot attain jhana while walking here. Okay, dear Bhante, very often people blame others and external situations for the greed, anger and delusion they experience. Yes, but wouldn't it be truer to say that these are only the triggers for what is coming from within? Exactly right, yes, I would agree with that. After all, an arahant in the same situation, even in the case of verbal and physical abuse, would not experience any defiled reaction. Quite right so, yes. Though they would experience painful and unpleasant feelings. In the physical sense, that's quite right, they would feel the physical body here. So they would feel the physical feelings in the body, that's right. Okay, with thanks for your sharing the light of the Dhamma. Well, okay, that's very kind of you to say that. Yeah, so that is quite right. I think it's one of the problems. Is everything okay at the back there? Yeah? Yeah? Oh, the cat. Okay. Oops. Okay.
We have too much of metta.
Too much metta, okay. Yeah, that's a good sign. That's a good thing. Okay. So, indeed, and I think it's important to always remember that it's so easy to blame the external things, but really it's much better to try to understand ourselves instead and try to focus on, well, not get upset because you get angry, not kind of get angry with yourself for being angry, then you're just compounding the problem, but trying to understand, trying to figure out, well, why am I getting angry? What's going on here? It's part of this contemplation of trying to find a way out of it, right? To understand that it's dangerous. How can I look at the situation in a different way so I don't get angry? And there's always another way of looking at things. And as you quite right say, that's often the way of the arahant who doesn't actually get angry here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for being here and teaching the Dhamma, of which I know very little, okay? So little that I don't know where the Dhammapada stems from. Are they extracts from the suttas, or are they standalone verses uttered by the Buddha at various points? Thank you. Okay. So the Dhammapada is one of the collections of verses found as part of the Sutta Pitaka. And the Sutta Pitaka is divided in five parts, and the fifth part is called the Kudaka Nikaya. Kudaka means the short Nikaya, and as things usually are, the so-called short Nikaya is actually the biggest one. That's how things often work out. And the reason for that, it probably is that originally the Kudakaya was quite smaller. And then over time it has kind of expanded and expanded and expanded and expanded. And because things were added to it, right? So it is no longer the Kudaka Nikaya, now it is more like the Maha Nikaya or something like that. It's very, very large. So for that reason, it is important to be a little bit careful when it comes to the Kudaka Nikaya. A lot of the scriptures found in the Kudaka Nikaya were clearly not uttered by the Buddha. They were added much later on. There are, and you can see that in many different ways when you look at various scriptures. You can see that the language is changing. It's not the same language in the suttas. The ideas, the doctrines start to change and evolve in new directions. When it comes to verse, you can look at the metrical style of the verse, the metrical style changes. And there are many, many criteria like that where you can look and see that actually this is not the same as the sutta. There is an evolution here. And of course, the other way, which is very interesting, you can see that there is a change, is by doing comparative studies. And when you do comparative studies, we were talking about the Abhidhamma the other day and asking whether the Abhidhamma really was spoken by the Buddha or not. And in comparative studies, it becomes very clear that the four main Nikayas of suttas, the Majjhima Nikaya, Digha, Sanyutta, and Anguttara as well, they are very similar across the different recensions. So if you take the Chinese version of the Majjhima compared with the Pali, it is very, very similar. But if you take the Abhidhamma and you compare that with the Abhidhamma of other systems, there's hardly anything in common at all. So how do you explain that? How do you explain that difference? And the way you explain that is that you by seeing that, you can see that the Majjhima Nikaya in the Chinese and the Pali, they have a common source. And that source must then go back to a time when the Sangha was united, right, in one group. That's where it came from. And the reason why the Abhidhamma is different in the different versions is because it arose, at least in part, after the Sangha started to split apart, and then it arose in different places, and that is why it is different. So the point here is that those things that are common in the different traditions are also likely to be the things that go all the way back to the time of the Buddha. So this is how you see these things. And with the Dhammapada, the Dhammapada is a mixture of all kinds of verse, and there is verse in the Dhammapada that is also found in other parts of the canon. So they are there, and that's certainly then, of course, authentic, being the word of the Buddha. There's also verse in the Dhammapada which is not found in other parts of the canon. So the Dhammapada seems to be like a bit of a mixed bag. Some of it is clearly the Buddha Vachana, the speech of the Buddha, and some of it, it's more difficult to say exactly where it comes from. And again, if you do comparative studies, you look at the different types of Dhammapadas, they vary quite a lot. The Chinese version of Dhammapada is called the Uddana Varga, from the Sanskrit, and that has, for example, over 1,000 verses, at least one of them. And those, whereas the Dhammapada we have has about, 400, just over 400 verses. So there's 400 versus 1,000. So you can see there is a lot of difference in development there. Okay, so that is roughly the Dhammapada. So part of it would be from the Buddha, other parts a bit more uncertain exactly what it is. Okay. Next one. What is the difference between Miccha Samadhi and Samma Samadhi? Okay. It's a good point, because it's not very obvious what that actually is. Please explain what is meant by Lokiya Jhana and Lokuttara Jhana. Okay? All right. What is the difference between Anusaya, underlying tendency, and Asava, outflowings? Okay? Finally, when Asavas are eradicated, Anusaya will also be destroyed, or do they become irrelevant? Okay? Well, here are some very serious Dhamma questions, and no messing around with this one. Okay. So, first of all, Miccha Samadhi and Samma Samadhi, what is the difference? And that is a very interesting point, because you see in the sequence we saw the other day, you saw that wrong view leads gradually throughout all the various factors of the path, wrong view, wrong intention, all the way up to wrong Samadhi. So what is actually meant by that wrong Samadhi? And then on the other side, you have right view leading all the way to right Samadhi. And one way of looking at that is because it is based on wrong view. Wrong view is the first factor here. One way of, it doesn't say this explicitly in the suttas, so it becomes a little bit of educated guesswork to actually know what it is. But one way, because it is based on wrong view, any kind of samadhi, any kind of even jhana perhaps, but which is conjoined with some aspect of wrong view, that might be called Miccha Samadhi. And the reason it is Miccha Samadhi is because when you come out of that kind of samadhi, it cannot really be used in the correct way, because you have wrong view. Because, for example, if you are, say you are somebody who believes in a god, right, of whatever religion, you will often take that jhana experience to mean union with God, seeing God for the first time, right? So because of that, the Miccha Ditti actually skews your ability, distorts your ability to understand reality as it is. So you can't actually progress any further. The Miccha Ditti stops you. And for that reason, it may be called Miccha Samadhi. So that is one way of looking at that. And I think quite possibly that is the right answer to that question. Second one, can you please explain what is meant by Lokiya Jhana and Lokuttara Jhana? Okay, Lokiya, these two terms are commentarial terms. They don't actually exist in the suttas as such. And the difference is that Lokuttarajana is a term that occurs first in the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And the idea with Lokuttarajana is that when, I have to say this is quite sort of specialized Dhamma, so you have to be really interested in the Dhamma to get into these kind of things, but it is also quite important, I think, at least sometimes, for getting the right idea what these things are here. So according to the Abhidhamma, when you penetrate to path and fruit, right, when you become a stream enterer, you become a once-returner, non-returner, or an arahant, that experience of reaching any of those stages happens when the mind experiences certain of the jhana factors. In other words, it's like the penetration to the truth happens like simultaneously with an experience of jhana. The two happen at the same time, or at least the jhana factors. So because the jhana factors are present, and it is similar to an experience of jhana with something else on top of it, it is called Lokuttarajana in the Abhidhamma. And what happens then later on in the commentaries will then say that you don't actually need ordinary jhana on the Noble Eightfold Path. Lokuttarajana is sufficient. So that is somehow, you know, you can see what happens here is that the idea of jhana gets slightly relegated into the background, because really it's not jhana anymore, it's actually the penetration to the truth itself. So you're starting to mix up the causes of enlightenment with the results. The results and the causes are kind of starting not to be separated anymore. But of course the Noble Eightfold Path is the path to enlightenment. Because it is the path to enlightenment, it is the cause, it is not the result itself. So I think the whole idea of Lokuttarajana, even if it is true, you cannot say that Lokuttarajana can be in place of ordinary jhana. Why? Because you are conflating cause and effect. Ordinary jhana is the cause, the experience of enlightenment is the effect. So the importance for the practice is basically the ordinary jhanas. It's not very ordinary, it's already Uttari Manusadhamma, right? It's beyond the human state. So to call it ordinary is a bit of a misnomer anyway. But that is what is talked about in the Noble Eightfold Path, not the so-called Lokuttarajana. I'm not sure if that made any sense to you whatsoever, but don't worry about it. This is very specialized things, which I'm sure the monastics here will appreciate what this is about. But I think very few lay people get into these specialized areas of Dhamma. Anyway, let's move on to the next one. What is the difference between anusaya and asava, the outflowing of the mind? Okay, so the anusaya is an underlying tendency, right? So the anusaya is not always present in the mind. It's not always there. It's just that there's a potential for that to arise at any time. And that potential means that it is an underlying tendency. It may not be there now, but it can arise at any time. And asava, on the other hand, is like an expression, right, as I understand it, is an expression of a problem. The asava, the kama asava, is actually an expression of sensuality right there and then. And when it is destroyed, then of course there is no possibility of that outflowing to happen anymore. When the mind flows out into the world, either through bhava asava, the asava of existence. My friend who is suffering from a stroke has been told that it may not be caused by past karma. Can you let me know what other causes can lead to conditions like this? Thank you very much. The basic cause for having a stroke is to be reborn as a human being. That is the main cause for having strokes. So remember that sometimes we take the idea of karma too far, right? We think that things are caused by karma, but really the main thing that karma does is places you in a certain rebirth. That is the main thing that karma is all about. So you have been reborn as a human being. Now that fact that you have been reborn as a human, that is karma. That is because of past conditions, things that you have done in the past. But all the things that happen as a human being, That's just what happened to humans. Humans have strokes, right? That's what happens to humans. Humans get fired from their job. Humans have all kinds of pains. Humans sometimes die early in plane crashes, in tsunamis, in cyclones, in earthquakes, and whatever. This is what happens to humans. So remember, there's a distinction here. Once you have been reborn as a human, you can expect human things to happen to you. These are all part of that. And even if you die young, say you die in your 30s or whatever because of some accident or something, you cannot be 100% sure that is due to karma. It could also be due simply because this is also what happens to humans. Sometimes they die young. What you can say is that if you have done some bad karma, and that is to ripen in this life, that karma may cause you to have a short life. But I think it's possible to have short life also, simply because you are a human being. And that is why, how you can explain, for example, if you think about the great tsunami that was, 10 years ago or something now, when, 100,000 people died, lots of people died, in particular in Sumatra, there were whole villages that were kind of destroyed and, you know, nobody survived, basically. How can it be that every single person in that village had the bad karma, they had to die right then? It doesn't really compute, it doesn't really make sense. And sometimes I think human life just is like that. Sometimes you die young, because that's what happens to human beings. Unless you have made very good karma. If you have done very good karma, that may protect you from dying in those situations. You always hear about somebody who miraculously wasn't there, right? And maybe that was because of good karma, that they escaped somehow. I hope that makes sense. Let's go on to the next one. Venerable Bhante, how can we protect ourselves from falling into the four woeful states? Okay. How you can protect yourself from that is by practicing your best of your ability in this life. Making sure that you keep the sila as well as possible. Make sure that you are a generous person, that you have a good heart, that you practice a bit of metta, a bit of meditation. All these things to purify yourself. The more pure you are as a person, the less chance it is that you will fall into a negative state in a future life. Remember, it is the mind, right? What is your mind like? If you have a good mind, there's very little chance that you will go to a bad destination afterwards. So if you have a joyful mind, a happy mind, a mind that is kind of immersed in Dhamma practice, there's almost no chance that you will be reborn in a bad state. So this is what matters, how you live your life. Sometimes people talk about the last kind of mind moment before you die, how important is that? It can matter a little bit perhaps, but that is not the main issue. The main issue is how we live. This kind of emphasis on the last mind moment, I think, tends to be very much overblown. It can matter, but imagine that you are a very good person. And let's say that you have a bad death, so you die with a bad thought or whatever. At the very most, what can happen is that you go to a bad destination for a very short time. And then your general karma will very soon take you back to a good place again. So regardless, it's your general conduct, your general karma, that is what is important, right? So purify yourself to the maximum. Do good, be a good person. And then you will be going the right direction. Got the wrong side, okay. Dear Bhante, often while meditating, I feel a persistent build-up of pressure in my head. And it sometimes leads me to yawn a lot as well. I have looked into potential causes of stopping my breathing or focusing too much on one spot, but neither seems to be the cause. This usually happens for a while, just preceding a very calm meditation. Could I be doing something that I should try to change? Or is this one of those things that just happen and I should take no notice of? Thank you. It is hard to say exactly what is happening, and if it is a real pressure or whether it's just a perception in your mind, it is something you have to find out for yourself. But be careful. Sometimes people do get headaches in meditation practice. is quite common, and particularly in some high-stress societies, like places like Singapore, for example. It's a very high-stress environment, and you know, people there often work incredibly long hours, and people are often very tense in those kind of societies, and because they are used to exerting their will all the time, often they also get headaches when they practice meditation. It's quite common. So be careful. Don't put so much force into the meditation practice that you get a headache. Make sure you don't do that. That could be one cause for this pressure that you're feeling inside the head. So if that is the case, just relax more. Just sit back and just allow things to be. Don't push yourself in meditation practice. Just relax. One of the problems, I think, with watching the breath, many people like to watch the breath here, on the upper lip or the nose, tip of the nose, or this area in general. And sometimes, unless your mindfulness is quite strong, it can be very restricting. And that, perhaps, for some people, that may give rise to a headache because you aren't really ready to narrow your attention down to such a small spot. So you need to relax more. You need to not focus so narrowly until your mindfulness becomes stronger. If that is not the problem, if you have checked it out and it's not a headache, that is a real headache, it's just a perception perhaps, then it's not really an issue. Then you can just keep going. And as you say here, if this precedes a state of great calm, then perhaps it is just a temporary perception that you have to work through before the mind calms down more. So it is hard for me to know exactly what is happening with you. You have to really test and experiment yourself. But be careful so you don't cause any problems for yourself. Okay, if we could make a robot whose behavior and speech were indistinguishable from a human, would it generate or have karma? If not, why not? What would make the difference, and how could we know? Okay, I think the point is that karma is intention, right? This is what the Buddha says in the Sutta. He says, "Kammang." What does it say? Chetana kammang badami, right? So it's intention that is karma, right? So can a robot really have intention? What a robot probably has, it has a program inside of itself that makes it go this way and go that way. It doesn't really have intention in the human way. To have intention, you have to have consciousness, right? These things go together. And if the robot really did have consciousness, then probably it could make karma. But presumably, it doesn't have any consciousness. So in that case, it cannot make any karma. I wonder what the robot might get reborn as. Interesting one. Some kind of robot heaven or something. Yeah. So essentially, I think the answer is no. There's no such possibility here. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, from where did you download the Tipitaka onto your Kindle? It's actually not my Kindle, that's the problem. I borrowed it from somebody else. Somebody said to me, oh, I have the Tipitaka, you might need it, take it on your trip. So that's unfortunate, so I don't actually know where it's from. But I think it is from the version of that particular Tipitaka I have. It's called the Chattasangayana Tipitaka. It's from the Burmese Sixth Council in Burma. And I think it is available on the VRI website. VRI is the Vipassana Research Institute, and they operate out of India. And if you just search on Vipassana Research Institute, I think it may have been downloaded from there. I'm not 100% sure. Is that where it would be from? You want Banzai? No? Okay. Maybe from there. We are uncertain here. So. Okay, thank you for your enjoyable and inspiring Sutta readings. Thank you. They are a great selection for this retreat. May you derive much merit from a wonderful teaching. Okay, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say that. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Okay, Venerable Sir, when sila of the body, word and mind purifies, does mindfulness become established on its own, or is it a process that needs attention and effort always? Basically, it gets established on its own. This is one of the points about the purification, is that mindfulness gradually increases and increases and increases. And you should be able to see that in your own practice. When I think about myself, what I was like when I started my training as a Buddhist or a monastic about 20 years ago, whatever it is now, and I compare it to myself now, I can see a great increase in the clarity of the mind, the clarity of the of being able to be present and all these kind of things. And you should see the same thing happening to you. You should see the increase in mindfulness. In fact, the Buddha said in the suttas that one of the ways you should always reflect on this, are you growing in wholesome qualities? And the wholesome qualities include things like mindfulness and samadhi, right? These are the kind of the foundational important qualities. So are you growing in those things? And if you are not, then something is wrong in the practice. You need to adjust something. And the Buddha said, for example, if you're not growing in those things and you're living in a certain place, you should leave that place and go somewhere else to make sure that these qualities start to increase. So whatever you need to do, because this is the purpose of the spiritual life, to have more mindfulness, to have more samadhi, to have more kindness, to have more gentleness. Now, if the purpose of the spiritual life does not materialize, then you're wasting your time. It's not working. There's no point anymore to this whole thing. So you have to make sure that the point of the spiritual life actually manifests. Otherwise, stop being a Buddhist, perhaps, or something like that. So please always investigate. If you find that it doesn't work, investigate why it doesn't work. And then, according to the Buddha's teachings, if you investigate rightly, if you do the right practice, it will always lead to the right results. I was just joking when I said don't be a Buddhist. I didn't mean that seriously. And it is also true that it does need some attention and effort always. And the reason for that is because even though you are increasing your mindfulness and it becomes very powerful, sometimes in daily life when you're very busy doing many things, mindfulness will go down, right? And it will disappear. So you have to, not disappear, but it will diminish. So then you need to go back home. You need to sit down. You need to relax. You need the tiredness to pass away, the restlessness to disappear. And then you find your mindfulness comes back again, right? So you need always to kind of care for it and look after it in this way. And then when you come on a retreat, meditation retreat, then you find that your mindfulness becomes much more powerful than it does in daily life. Because here you can really relax and really rest and really take it easy. And one of the things I always recommend people to do is that every year when you go on a meditation retreat, many people go like once a year. So if that is what you do, check out what has happened in that year. Are you improving? Have you become more mindful? Have things happened in the meantime? And if you can see from year to year that you're making progress, then you know that you're also practicing in the right way in daily life, right? You know that you're doing the right things, you're putting in the causes, and you're getting the results because of that. So this is one way of monitoring your practice, to always look, is it working? In this way, we become real practicing Buddhists, not just book Buddhists, but Buddhists of the heart, who actually make sure we're going the right way. Okay, two questions here. Does being a vegetarian help with sila and meditation? That's question number one. Was number two, in the walking meditation, where does or should the mind rest? What is the technique? Okay, being a vegetarian, does that help with sila and meditation? It can do. It, as with so many things, it depends how you use it. But if you think to yourself how wonderful it is to support the non-slaughter, the non-killing of animals, and I want to support this to the best of my ability by being a vegetarian, you can make a beautiful mind state out of that. And if you use that in a skillful way, yes, it can be a support for meditation practice. It can be an act of compassion not to eat meat, right? At the same time, be careful. Sometimes people who are vegetarians, they become critical of non-vegetarians. And if you are critical of non-vegetarians, you might destroy the happiness you get from being a vegetarian. So be careful not to be critical about that. Because the Buddha did not lay down that we have to be vegetarians. Because he didn't lay it down, it means it is not really an absolutely critical part of the path. It may be helpful, but it may not hinder you that much either if you're not a vegetarian. So it is all about how we use these things, right? That is the most important thing here. So, in the walking meditation, where does or should the mind rest? Now, it all depends on why you do walking meditation. What is the purpose of the walking meditation? And the purpose should be decided by what you need to do. So say that you have been sitting, and after a while the meditation isn't working very well, you feel a bit restless or whatever, and you need to go out to do something else. If that is the case, I would say, don't try to force the mind onto an object. Just walk back and forth and just relax and just enjoy yourself and just try to feel the peace and enjoy being here, right? Being on the retreat or whatever. Don't use any force on the mind, because the mind just needs a bit of a break probably. It's feeling restless or whatever. So you have to know what the problem is inside, what you're trying to achieve. Or you feel like you're not getting anywhere in meditation. You're not getting anywhere, okay. So maybe you need to contemplate something. Maybe you need to contemplate death so that you can sort of take out some of the defilements of the mind. Maybe you need to contemplate a bit of impermanence perhaps. Whatever it is, maybe do a bit of metta. And these are things you also can do while doing walking meditation. You know, sometimes when you walk, because there is a movement, the contemplation can flow more easily while you're walking than when you're sitting down. So walking is great for contemplation, really good for that. Whatever reflection you need to do. Or if your sitting meditation is going really well, you feel peaceful, and you just want to continue with samatha meditation while you walk, and usually the way to do samatha meditation while you're walking, this is the standard practice in many places, is to focus on the attention on your feet as you're walking back and forth. That is a common way of doing it. So you just keep your attention on the feet. And that can in itself be a very, very beautiful meditation. Even there, you can experience lots of bliss just by watching the feet as you walk back and forth. And then, when you've had sometimes you get a bit stiff from sitting too long, you walk a bit. If you keep your attention on the feet, then when you go back to sit again, you can continue where you left off in the meditation before. So these are all ways. I know that in certain meditation systems, they also talk about watching the breath well enough to be called a thought. It's certainly nothing to do with verbalization or anything like that. So no thinking in jhana. If you can think, it is definitely not a jhana. Does he see manorupa? So manorupa is like mental form, right? A form of the mind. Well, basically, there is no seeing, there is no senses at all, right? Operating in the jhana state. So I'm not sure exactly what you mean here by manorupa. But there is, the thing here is that the full elimination of form only really happens when you enter the immaterial realms, right? Prior to the immaterial realm, there's still some remnant of form left in the jhanas. Exactly what that is not very clear. It's just part of the perception which has some kind of form feature to it. And it's very it's not form in the ordinary sense. It's just some aspect of that perception. It's a completely unified perception in jhana, except for in the first one. But there is an aspect to that perception which has a form quality, and that only disappears when you get to the immaterial realms. I hope that makes sense to you. Okay, next one. Okay, is it possible to maintain a silent state of mind even when we are not meditating? I tried this out but didn't seem to work. I feel that I'm addicted to the silence of the mind, but it wouldn't be possible to close our eyes to achieve silence during our day-to-day social interactions. Please advise. Thank you so much. You are quite right, and I'm very glad to see that you are addicted to the silence of the mind. It's a very good addiction. Ajahn Brahm, my meditation teacher, Ajahn Brahm always says that you should be addicted to the jhanas. I think he's kind of put, you know, adding a bit of extra emphasis on that. I don't think it's really addiction in the ordinary sense, but the idea is that you should enjoy these jhanas. You should have a certain amount of delight and wish to practice these things whenever you have the possibility here. So your addiction to silence is a good addiction. It's a good attachment. It's a thing that will lead you to much progress in the Dhamma if you have that kind of addiction. So it's great. But you have also to learn to be able, at times when you cannot achieve that silence, to actually be able to let go and say, okay, I can't have it now, even though I'm addicted to it, now I'm going to have to operate in a normal way in society here. So you have to be able to let go and to actually live in an ordinary way, in ordinary society. Otherwise, it becomes hopeless, right? Otherwise, life becomes impossible. Unless you want to ordain, in which case you have much more chance for being silent and being quiet. So I can always recommend ordination as a monastic. It's a very, very good lifestyle. So if you have that inclination, at least you can come to the monastery and check it out and see if it is something that might fit your situation. Otherwise, well done on your practice. Okay, Venerable Bhante, can you explain more about sense restraint, restraint in food, restraint in sleeping, that will lead to a happy monastic life? Thank you. Okay, so all of these restraints, remember what I was talking about today, it's about finding the middle way, right? All of these things, particularly about food and about sleep, is not just restraint for restraint's sake, is to find a way whereby you are neither suffering because of deprivation, nor are you suffering because of craving. You find a middle way, which is just the right balance. And when you have that right balance, that is when it is right. And remember that in the suttas, they talk about the moderation in eating, the bhojana matanyuta, and also the wakefulness. But that comes after sense restraint. So it actually comes on the path fairly, when you're fairly advanced already and your mindfulness is quite strong, that is when these things really start to arise and become important. Always make sure you get things in the right sequence. Wakefulness is often described in very lofty terms. You sleep only in the middle watch of the night, which means 4 hours a night, and the rest of the time you basically practice meditation. Now, to be able to do that, you already need to be very firmly established in all the preliminary practices, right? This is not something that comes early on the path. It comes when the path is well established. And in fact, the Buddha says that somebody who has these qualities, sense restraint, the moderation, eating, and the wakefulness, is somebody who is actually in the presence of Nibbana. You're already getting very close when you have that. Because you are delighting in the practice, your practicing goes very smoothly, everything is going the right way, so you're getting close at that particular point. So that is how difficult it is to practice those things fully. But remember that sense restraint is mostly, as I understand, about wisdom. You know when to turn away, you know how to change your focus on that object which otherwise might give rise to desire or ill will. That's the main thing about it. Okay, dear Ajahn, on a number of occasions I have noticed Ajahn Brahm pointing to or highlighting the point at which the breath stops during the transition from inhaling to exhaling or vice versa. Is there any special significance for E.g., he does not point much to any other sensation, such as the belly movement or the sense of air on the nostrils. Okay, I don't really know what Ajahn Brahm is pointing to there. Probably what he is pointing to is just to the peace, right? At the point when the breath stops, at that point it's very peaceful. So it's probably maybe teaching you just to learn to look at the peace itself. And by focusing on the peace, usually the mind calms down, right? And then the breath calms down more. So maybe it is a technique to help you to calm down and then to move the meditation along. Okay, dear Bhante, often Buddhism is accused of being pessimistic, but the removal of Resentment Sutta and the Punyavada Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya show that this isn't the case, don't they? Yes, I agree. Buddhism is not pessimistic. Buddhism is rather, I would say, realistic. It's about realism. Buddhism is not really about being either pessimistic or optimistic. It's about being realistic. We want to see the world as it actually is. Yatha Bhuta Jnanadarsana means understanding things as they actually are. If you go around in the cloud of optimism, pretending that the world is in a way that it isn't, you're going to suffer because of that. You're going to suffer even more. There's no point in being stupidly optimistic if the reality actually is different. So indeed, it's about being, not only is it about being realistic, but as you're pointing out here, it's about actually creating good emotions, right? About removing the negative and creating the good inside oneself. And the Punyavada Sutta is very interesting. I don't know if you are familiar with the Punyavada Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya. Punyavada Sutta is a sutta with Punna. He comes to the Buddha and Punna says to the Buddha, I want to go to the Aparantaka country. And the Aparantaka country, the Buddha says, oh, but that is a very fierce country. The people there are very fierce and very difficult. Are you sure you want to go to the Aparantaka country? What if people abuse you? Punna says, well, if they abuse me, I will thank them for not hitting me with sticks. And then the Buddha said, but what if they do hit you with sticks? Well, then I will thank them for not throwing clods of earth at me. But what if they do throw clods of earth at you? Well, then I will thank them for not stabbing with knives. But what if they do stab you with knives? Well, then I will thank them for not killing me. But what if they do kill me? Well, at least I wouldn't have to search for somebody to kill me. Something to that effect is what he says. So it's a very positive view, right, of things. So that's the Punyavada Sutta for you. So then the Buddha says, well, then you can go, because you're obviously ready for that. Yes. Okay, do you think the Buddha was possibly one of the earliest exponents of positive thinking? Indeed, I think that's a very good point. He was very much into positive thinking. He was into metta bhavana and into seeing the good in other people and practicing happiness and joy in life. I think that is a very good point, actually. He was certainly into positive thinking. But he was into a kind of positive thinking that was also realistic. It wasn't a kind of deluded positive thinking, right? It was a mixture of realism and positivity. And that is what I think is so powerful about the Buddha's teachings. I think a lot of other positive thinking may often be, actually, sometimes at least, probably can be deluded thinking as well. Okay, thank you for sharing the Dhamma so generously. Very good. Okay. Oh, it's getting very late. Okay, we'll do this one. Venerable Sir, can you kindly explain what Vedana Sanya is? Vedana Sanya. Okay, I'm not sure if the word Vedana Sanya as such occurs anywhere in the suttas. What that would mean is basically perception of feeling. That's what that would mean, Vedana Sanya. So it just means you are percipient of feelings, basically. You are aware of the feelings. That's what Vedana Sanya would mean. So maybe what you are referring to is the Vedana Nupassana. The Vedana Nupassana is the Satipatthana, where you contemplate feelings, right? This is Vedana Satipatthana, Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings. How should one do that? I will get to that one of these days. But one of the ways, or the main way that the Buddha explains that in the suttas, is that Vedananupassana is done when you do Anapanasati practice. That's also when you do Vedananupassana. Okay, I think I better stop there. Let us all together pay homage to the Triple Chin.